I will do the refuge in bodhicitta in English. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings.
Can you hear me? Oh, yeah. So before we start, also just reflect. I think everyone is some familiar with Buddhism, right? I don't know if you'd be here otherwise. Okay, so just the main thing that makes this different tonight and any night, anything we do, is motivation. We can talk about that more as we go on. But just if you can just for a moment reflect on whatever it is that you... how you relate to motivating with a good heart, open heart, so that what we do tonight, what we discuss, what we talk about, what you hear, what I hear, what we listen to, what we think about. So all those moments are imprinted on our consciousness, and they will ripen in the future, for sure. So then we can motivate that all those imprints, everything that we discuss, we experience, even driving here when you're coming on your way here. I think the best motivation is that these imprints ripen, ripen in a way that leads to a fully awakened mind, which is a fully healthy mind, a mind that is affectionate towards others, that takes others' concerns into our heart. Okay? So even though we're talking, whatever subject we're talking about, it has the direct result of a fully awakened mind within ourselves and all living beings. Okay? Maybe you already motivated that way on the way over here. So you can do it again. Okay. So, is this working okay? Okay. So I didn't make any slides tonight. I thought maybe we could have, as part of this evening, maybe slightly more casual. I will lead it off. But I thought maybe it's good to have some sort of dialogue back and forth. Maybe that's helpful for people. It's helpful for me. Tonight, what I was asked to speak on, which is, as you know, around, I don't remember how it was worded, but my understanding is about parenting as a Buddhist or with Buddhist ideas. I thought there was compassion in there somewhere. Was it compassion in there? No.
Nah.
Good. So some people were here last night, and some people here tonight were not here last night. But specifically in terms of introducing myself, maybe it's more relevant to let you know that so parenting. For myself, I am a parent. My children are grown up now. I have three children. Son is 31, my daughter's 29, and my youngest son, I think he's 26. Yeah, I think so. Is he 25? His birthday's next month. Anyway, he's going to kill me. I think he's 25. So I do have some experience with parenting. I've been a Buddhist for a long time, in one way of saying long time. As I mentioned last night, I was interested, as a young person, I was interested in spiritual things. And ended up going to college, and fortunately for me, the college I was going to had a year in Nepal program in my junior year. And I stayed a year and a half at that point. I had to come back, finish my degree for a year and a half, and then went back for another 10 or 11 years. So those years, 1975 to 1988, and during that time, I was asked by my root teacher, Lama Yeshe, to... That's an interesting little story. When I was there for the first year and a half, I went up for what's become quite well known as the November course. And that was like, it was numbered 8, but I think it was only the 4th November. And I started teaching, teaching a couple of the young monks, English, you know, as a volunteer. I didn't know about teaching, of course, didn't know anything about teaching. And, which is often the point at the end of the year and a half, I found that time so meaningful. I loved Nepal, and didn't really want to leave, but I had to leave. And so I had the really good fortune to be invited to breakfast with Lama Yeshe. And it was up on the top of the mountain. I vividly remember it was February, you know, on the top of the mountain. And you got to understand that when I was living there, it was really poor. I mean, it was tough poor. Yeah, and like in monsoon, we'd be up there and start running out of food at the end of the monsoon, and the road would be all washed out, and because we run out of money, and then pretty soon it was like rice with this overcooked, spinach, and this really watery dal, and it didn't weigh very much, didn't gain very much weight, and so I felt very honored because I was pretty, Lama Yeshe is an intimidating. Very loving, very, very, very affectionate, warm. I mean, very, very special human being. And for most people, their experience of him was as, you know, your favorite uncle kind of thing, you know. And he was very unusual. I'll talk about him more over the next some days. Because he's everything. And him, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, everything I have to share with you comes from them. So there he was. He invited me to breakfast. And I said, how strange, you know, because I was just him having breakfast with this great Lama. It was Lama Zopa's teacher and very intimidating figure for me. So I don't know if you have that experience. You know, so I was, how old was I? Like 23? And so here we are. And I'm having this breakfast with him, and there's like hard-boiled eggs. And there's white bread. When I say white bread, that's like special, you know, because we were just eating chapatis with that wholemeal bread, you know, and he had this peanut butter, you know, it's really good, and something else, and I think some juice, of course, out of the can, but for me it was like a miracle, you know, having this lunch, breakfast, but I was so nervous I could hardly eat, and he's making small talk and talking, and anyone know that, like you're having, who would be similar having breakfast with whom? His Holiness. Well, what about for people, I don't know, like the president or something? Yeah. And so I got the guts up because I really wanted to ask him. Okay, I had an agenda. I want to know what I should do with my life now. You know, I was going back to the States for this amazing year and a half. So I finally got the courage up to say, you know, kind of sort of weak voice. I remember. So Lama, now what should I do? And his whole demeanor changed. Well, it was a relaxing breakfast for him anyway. You know, he scowled and he's like you asked really some question about, I don't know, vacuum cleaners or something. And he told us, and he went like this, I never tell my students what to do. So then I felt really stupid, right? I went back to eating, and I couldn't eat at all then. And it was probably about 3 or 4, really long pause. I mean, this pregnant pause, and I was really uncomfortable. 3 or 4 minutes, I'm trying to eat. So then he looked at me and said, so when you return next year, I'd like you to teach my monks. So he did tell me. So I came back to the States, and I studied English as a second language, because in those days in Nepal, you couldn't stay more than 3 months, unless you had either a student visa or a visa, a development, you know, for aid. So I knew the student way. So I found a university. I was talking to earlier. Anyway, this university, one college in the United States that offered independent master's programs. So I had a 10-year master's degree program. I stretched out that visa, I tell you that. So I worked, so it was interesting. So I did, so I studied for the year and a half I was back. I studied ESL and started, and went back to Nepal and set up the English as Second Language program. Lamyash is very progressive because no one was doing that sort of thing in a monastery in those days. In fact, we were criticized by the other monasteries. Very, you know, Tibetans have this way of talking about each other with big smiles and very nice. But they couldn't understand why we would be teaching English other than, you know, he must want his monks to do business in Hong Kong or something like that. So, of course, now all the monasteries will have an English program. So I did work, we did not only English, but set up English, social studies, and mathematics program, and because Lamyash is very forward-thinking, I mean, he was way ahead of his time, and he was exactly right, they would need those kinds of modern disciplines to make it, you know, through today's world. I could go on and on about that, but the point of it being that I did, so I worked with young monks for many years. Most of our monks were under 25. Most of them were under 12, actually. And so I worked there. Then I, Lama Zobra Rinpoche, after Lamyash had passed away some years before, I was in the States for a meeting and with Lama Zobra Rinpoche, and that's when, out of nowhere, he said, you know, maybe it's a good time to move back to the West. And then after discussion, he said it'd be good to study psychology, which is not, I think, a natural segue from what I was doing in Nepal, which was very foreign, you know, big distance from what, how do you translate what you do in those kinds of indigenous cultures long ago to trying to live in this modern culture, but it was the right choice. So I did get my master's in clinical psychology. I did work with young kids for a while, not my specialty in that sense. Later part of my practice, I worked with lots of teens and families and things like that. And my own three kids. That's the main qualification is my own three children. So I've been a Buddhist a long time, and I have had this, like probably many people, struggle with figuring out how do I parent as a Buddhist? You know, is there anything special about that? And honestly, I would say there's nothing special about it. I mean, whether you're, you know, as a Buddhist, I mean, do you have to think specially about parenting more than you think specially about how to be a Buddhist at work? Right? I don't think so. I think it's all the similar challenge, is what my point is. So I think we're very fortunate, or very lucky, we could say, in this tradition, because the idea of transformation through utilizing your problems is a big part of our practice, isn't it? It's really taught a lot, you know, we spend a lot of time on talking about the enemy as your friend and developing patience and developing compassion and all, you know, the main message is not meditate, go to a cave, retreat. We do those things. But I wouldn't say that those are the number one emphasis. Number one emphasis is develop a good heart, develop wisdom. And liberate or enlighten all living beings. Isn't that, I think that's the number one theme. If I were to pluck a theme out. You know, you could say, I think some other traditions, the theme you pluck out might be meditate, you know, go and retreat. You know, it could be. I mean, I don't want to name any, but you know, you could see that. And even a particular teacher could have emphasized that too. But I think in our tradition, even with our teachers say, but also from this tradition, which is Tibetan Buddhist tradition or the Gelug tradition, and I'm not saying as exclusive to the other three traditions, Nyingma, Kagyu, and Shakya, but just this is the one I know. The idea of benefiting others is probably the main idea. Wouldn't you say? Huh? Right? Now, talk about benefiting others, then we start talking about, well, you need to be enlightened, you need to develop bodhicitta, you need to develop skillful me, you know, all those other things. And to do that, you need a trained mind, you know, to train your mind, you need to meditate, you need to be focused, right? So So that's where all those other things, but you think about where all those practices come from, not come from, but what all those practices are aimed towards, it's towards enlightenment. Enlightenment means a fully awakened mind or a fully healthy mind, right? A fully healthy, clear, balanced mind. Why? Well, in this tradition, it's not just to, you know, kick back once you get that. And you start serving from the moment you actually start to practice, really. You try. We try. Okay, but to really be effective for people, so I can throw this on you. If you think about parenting, to really be effective with your kids, you just have to become enlightened. Right? Yeah. I know what your question is next. What about in the meantime? So a few just broad strokes about that is, well, I'll tell you about myself, to bring it into context. When I was living at Copan and in those years, particularly the early years, you know, I learned Nepalese language. We had a intensive Nepalese in the college program, so I didn't think I could learn languages, right? Anyone fail like Spanish in high school? Ah, good. And you probably developed, see, I don't know about you, but then the idea was, oh, Karuna can't learn languages, right? God, that's so damaging to kids. Don't do that with your kids. So I went to Nepal and I learned Nepalese, in the 6 months of intensive we did, 4 hours a day, living in a village with a family. I mean, I learned really good Nepalese, and over many years it got better. So don't think you can't learn a language if you had that experience. You just didn't learn it the way that you learn. That's what I found anyway. But I really thought, because I liked studying, when I met the Dharma, I really loved the philosophy, I really loved the psychology, I really loved the theory, and meditation, all that seemed really very, very familiar or conducive. I loved it. And then, you know, again, Lam Yeshe. So, Lam Yeshe, for me, was very wrathful, stern. Most people's experience him, you can see him on videotape, experience him was these, like I said before, unbelievably warm, open, expansive, kind, communicative, you know, connect. You could connect with everybody. My parents loved him. They were not Buddhists. But a few of us were, I think, kind of maybe really hard-headed or something, or hard to... And he was quite... So my time with him, the honeymoon was a couple months, and after that it was rocky marriage. You know what I'm saying? And the kindness, I can't even tell you the kindness. So he was very wrathful. He was very strict. He was very mean. But I can't imagine, the kindness, I can't even tell you the level. There's nothing in this world like that. So it worked. So he was scary for me. And so, my wife, and Lam Yeshe and Lam Zom Rinpoche used to go to Dharamsala every winter, for his only teachings, and they would do retreat and stuff. And every winter they would go, and he'd tell my wife, you know, she should come to retreat then too, take the teachings. And I'd be like standing there, you know. But I had learned a lot. Don't ask him. Because if I asked him, then I got some criticism back, you know. But one day I went up to his room one day, and yeah, I can't remember why, but there he was, and maybe it was for a meeting or something, my wife and he were in there, and you know, you could see, you come in the room and the teacups are all empty. And the cookies are all eaten, right? The crumbs are kind of there. And I go in, I just remember vividly, Lama's like so, he'd been laughing so much, like he had almost tears coming down his eyes, you know, because I remember looking at my wife and she had a big smile. So whatever they were doing was very engaging and what if. Then the wet blanket comes in. And Lama looks at me and says, oh, Pam and I are discussing how we're going to Dharamsala this winter. And we were talking about how we're going to go to His Holiness' teachings. He's setting me up, right? And he said, oh, and then we're going to do retreat. Oh, it's going to be so good. Dharamsala is beautiful that time, like that. So finally, this is about the third year in a row this is happening. So finally I looked at him and I said, like that voice I told you about at that breakfast. And I said, so stupid. I just never learned. I had to say, what about me, Lama? Again, his voice, exact same expression. And he just looked at me and said, you stay here and work. Told me that every year. You know? And so work wasn't easy for me. But it's easier to go to retreat, to study, to do those things. Yeah. So my point of the story is I really want to do retreat, study, and he told me don't become a translator. I don't want you to become a translator. It's like all the things that if I wanted to do, he would say, no, I can't do that, right? And then even getting married. I mean, I'm very happily married, but he had to talk us into it. He talked to us, he kept asking, when are you going to get married? When are you going to get married? And, I had some kind of thing like, well, I thought I might become a monk, translator. He said, no translator. Study. And you've already studied a lot. Retreats. Oh, you've done so many retreats. Like that. I mean, I hadn't, but he just kept saying it. I couldn't argue with him. The point is that so all that led to, besides the great fortune of working closely with him, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, I mean, and we don't know what we don't know. So I thought the way to become, to develop was retreat, study, and I did study, and I did some retreats, but not like how I would have wanted to. We don't know, but his method was putting me in difficult situations. No doubt about it. I didn't really want to work like that. I'm not a great worker. I didn't think about having kids. I think I'm not unusual in that way. I guess it was a natural progression, but I had some, fear like, oh, I'm going to lose my... If I have kids, I can't do retreat. If I have kids, I can't really study. Oh, I'm going to have to go get a job. So I struggled with that. I did. And guess what? In my struggle, I had to... What I needed to do is let go. All that is self-centered. Really, I can't say for everybody, but obviously it was self-centered. And then to work for my kids and my family was other-centered. So in a very conventional sense, he helped me develop more of a sense of, generosity. Like, isn't that weird? Normally you wouldn't say, yeah, don't study, don't retreat. You do those things. But his wisdom, if in my case, his wisdom, of course, was perfect. And I think I became a better person by doing, family and raising children, working. Not that I would want to do that my whole, until I die. I hope I get some retreat time. He promised me he would put me in retreat, so I trust that that'll happen. Long retreat, he said. He said, after you'll do your long retreat. It maybe means I'm going to, when I die, I'm just thinking about that now. Maybe that's what he means. Your death is your long retreat. So, one last thing on that. I'm not trying to, again, I hope it doesn't sound like I'm bragging. I don't, I'm just trying to share my story. Lama Zopa Rinpoche was visiting not long ago, some years ago, 5, 6, 7 years ago, I was having dinner at our house, and out of nowhere, when he was and he spent the whole evening. I mentioned I have 3 kids. My oldest son was away; he was at college, but the 2 younger ones, he spent the whole evening talking to them. My wife and I kept trying to have these conversations, and he was just like ignore us, and they would just they talk for hours, had a really nice engagement back. I don't even remember, We weren't part of this. Almost like we weren't there. But when he was leaving, he said something that's like the most precious thing, really. He said, I was standing at the front door about to walk out, and he turned to us and he said, you can see it was all worth it. All those retreats you gave up. It's like he knew what Lama Yeshe had done. All those retreats you gave up. He said to both myself and my wife. All those retreats you gave up. All the teachings you missed. All the things you wanted to do. He says, you can see now, this raising your children had a lot more merit than if you'd done all that. He says, because now, you see, and this we'll talk about this, he says, because from them, then more people will get interested in the Dharma. Because you have 3 kids, And from those three, maybe three other people, and then it starts multiplying. So that's greater merit than if you had done those retreats and done those classes and like that. So we can't. It's so hard to see, isn't it? So Kondo gave me some questions. I asked her to give me, you know, some prompts for tonight, and she gave me six prompts, I think. And I can look at those and respond to them, or we can, if you have questions too, we can go either way. I can start off with these and then lead into questions. Does anyone have anything right at the moment that's germane to what we've already spoken about? Not what I'm going to speak about. What I did speak about.
Rune, did you get my second email?
Yeah. Yeah. That question was easy. But feel free to, like, if you want to start having dialogue, because it's nice not to really just blah, blah. That's my history, and as far as some of my history with being a parent and thinking about these ideas. Now, one of the questions in here, I don't know where it falls, but I will share with you, implied in these questions, is how do you... There's two kind of angles of questions. One is, how do I be a Buddhist, a practicing Buddhist as a parent? The other one is, how do I have my kids being Buddhists as a parent? I'll answer the second one first. Maybe it's answering the first one too. Our style is like this. I can't say it's right for you, but I do have some sense of bias that it was a really good style. And the way I would, maybe I'll explain that style with a question. How many people here were raised in traditional religious upbringing? Catholic, whatever, doesn't matter. Okay. How many of you are still followers of that? You raised as what? What was your
Hindu
so far? So one person of all the people who raised their hands. And that is very profound to me. I'm really curious why you still are, but we'll get into that later. Think about that. Why aren't you? Why aren't you still in the, you know, you're raised traditionally, your parents tried to do probably a good job, and they wanted you to, you know, be raised as, you know, Catholic or Christian or Jewish or whatever it was, right? And yet you're not. It's not a rhetorical question, it's actually a practical question. But that question sort of haunted is too strong a word, but you know, that question was on my mind as raising kids, and I think probably my wife as well. So our style, you know, we came from a very traditional Buddhist culture. We were living at Koh Phan. We built a house up there. It's a monastery. And you think when we raise our kids, they're going to be, you know, sitting on the cushion an hour a day and, you know, prostrations. What is that? Oh. I thought we're not near the airport, are we? Right? They weren't doing 35 prostrations every morning, and we weren't taking them to pujas over at the center that much. You know, so I would say to you, and again, I'm just sharing my beliefs and what we did. Goes to question one, how do you be a Buddhist? So, when I moved back to the States in 88, I had to start commuting up to about an hour away in Palo Alto, Stanford. So I needed a new car, a better car. And so I remember, you know, then you bought cars from the classified ads, and you had to go over there, right? So I was going over to San Jose. It's about a 40-minute drive from my home. And I was looking at buying a Mazda something or other. This is like 1991 or something, okay? And I'm trying to read the address. I'm driving where the Mazda, and right above Mazda is the letter L, right? L becomes for M. And it said Lexus. Just the first couple years they came out. And it was far out of my, you know, range, but the price said something that was within my range. I thought, that can't be. And so obviously it was like a teaser. But the problem was they had just put the ad in that day, so I was like one of the first ones over there, because they could leave the ad in for weeks and the car would be gone, right? So I said, well, let me see what this Lexus thing is all about. So I went over, and it was in my price range, and it was used, and the guy says, yeah, he's very laid back, you know, sale, which is unusual for a car salesman. And I said, you know, I came to look at, I wanted to see what this Lexus is. He said, oh, sure, come on. And he hands me the keys. Not really a sales pitch. And he says, let's just go for a ride. And so I said, okay. And it was a 5-speed, which I liked. So we're driving, and he's going, oh, go on the freeway here. Oh, you know, accelerate more. You know, only go on 60. You know, let's see you go. See how fast this thing goes or something. How fast it goes. He said, okay, now go on this off-ramp here, and the turn is really nice. You know, just see how this thing corners. We're driving like that. And it was about a 20-minute drive. We get back to the lot, and he gets out, and he says, okay, well, if you have any questions, let me know. I'll just be inside. I was like, wait a minute, aren't you a car salesman? So I ended up buying the car. I went and found him. I looked around and found him. And then at the end, I said, well, so what's the deal with you guys? You know, you didn't do any sale. I mean, you didn't hard sell me. And he said, the car sells itself. My advice is that if you want your kids to develop into Buddhist values, just do it yourself. It sells itself. It sells itself. With our kids, yeah, occasionally, you know, we had a connection with Buddhists from Copan, and, you know, we had connections. So coming in and out of our house was not unusual. There'd be lamas and monks and, you know, sort of the cultural parts of Buddhism they were familiar with. But as far as, like, teachings and pujas, I mean, occasionally, a couple times a year maybe. But the most important thing is we did not hide our belief system, you know. So we did, you know, just we tried to live it. We tried to, and we're talking about values now, not culture. So the values of Buddhism in the sense of not killing, okay, being sincere, being honest, you know, not stealing, not lying, those kinds of things. But to communicate those ideas, we did share those, you know, we did communicate those values very clearly. Sometimes at night we might read a particular, you know, as a little, you know, reading a particular kinds of, we chose the kind of books that we would read to them, not all Buddhist, not by any means, probably most not Buddhist books, but we were very careful about, do these books communicate the values? Then watching TV. You know, how do you watch TV? How do you watch TV? It's funny, because I think my wife is a little more, you know, she's like more like, they shouldn't watch TV or they shouldn't watch, you know, whatever, you know, the latest, you know, kind of movies that are released, whatever, violent or... And I was always like, well, no, this is my philosophy. I'd say, you know, maybe she was too, but, you know, I was not so worried about that. Like video games were coming out. And my theory was, whatever you deny becomes enticing. So you just don't make a big deal. Oh, video game. But, you know, you put some structure, you know, you put, but maybe not violence. Or maybe not watching TV during the week. Or not, you know, kind of more, and then, but always explaining. Everything is about explaining to, I think, everything is about explaining to your kids why. When I was training as a therapist, they said, you know, one question that you don't deal with is why. I said, really? When you were training, did they tell you that?
Yeah.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. Isn't that ridiculous? It's all about why. Well, it's also how, but, you know? So, you know, with kids always ask why. I think we should explain it to them. Mm-hmm. And if you can't, then don't put it on them, maybe. Wait till you figure it out. So, like, not killing. That's easy to explain why not. Because you start teaching empathy. You know, really not to kill is because, well, you don't have to go in the whole karmic, you know, four results and, you know, be reborn, the environmental result, and the rebirth result, and the habit. Yeah, I'm joking. You don't go into that. You just come from a very, very human point of view that you start, they can see that animals, insects experience something. Kids see it much easier than we do, I think. So you just go to the practical. I really think the practical. And let them figure it out. I think we can be very insecure. We can get very worried about our kids. I think if you do in your practice, and this is my belief, you develop a compassionate mind and you live your values, and then you share, like, this is what I believe, you know, with your kids, and you say, you know, you can try it out. I think they'll get it. Kids, those of you who work with kids know how incredibly open and sensitive children are, you know. They're miracles. And so I think it comes back to your practice. One is them. Maybe Lama Zopa would really beat me up, but I don't think it's about teaching doctrine. I would be even careful about teaching, like, ritual. Ritual is good, by the way, but do ritual that's natural for them. You know, discuss with them what ritual, because really ritual in itself is mostly a cultural thing, isn't it? Like, let's just say prostrations. What is the whole idea of prostrations? Why are they even developed? Do you think the prostration is because of the prostration, or do you think it's the meaning behind the prostration? So teach the kids what the meaning is, why you prostrate. But certainly, if you think you're prostrating to a painting, that's not going to probably fly with them. You know, and shouldn't be why we're prostrating anyway, personally. Share my opinion with you, sorry. You know, we're prostrating to a principle, right? And a principle that happens to be embodied and is living as well in terms of prostrations. So you share with them those universal principles like Lama Yeshe spoke about. So instead of saying, you know, you can talk about Buddha, but you should talk about Buddha, whatever, but you know, you're more than talking about from the point of view of an awakened being that's highly compassionate, cares, kind, but not in the sense of God, because that's very confusing for kids. You know, the God principle is very confusing when bad things happen. That's just a word of caution. You just go really slow and don't be so worried. Your kids will be actually more resilient and, I think, slow, and just live your principles. Is what I would say. And, you know, you so I remember my kids coming home from school one time all three children said this, but they remember them saying, "Do you guys have to have those bowls of water out?" They wanted to bring their friends over, and, you know, we'd have Tonkas and look like a monastery in there. So we did alter that for them, of course. You know, friendships and social relations are very important. That we don't want them, you know, to worry. Now, some people say, well, no, I mean, it's your values. They should, you know, be comfortable with their values and stick up for their values, you know. Dogmatism. So one of the questions I had for you tonight, or for you to think about, I think one of the most important things, when you think about this throughout your child-rearing time, which, doesn't really end until you die, because you're, as I was saying, as Susan and I were talking, she's never not a mother, even though her children are adults, right? You're still a mother. Just a different mother. You're a mother of adults. So what I would say to really contemplate is two questions, probably more, but these are lifelong questions. Is really spend time with your partner, talking about if you have a partner, talking about what do you want your kids to look like? Not physically. What do you want them to look like when they're young adults? In other words, what do you want them to become? Because if you look at it from the point of view of what you want them to become, then the troubles they go through, and probably will go through troubles, seem very different. Okay? A friend of mine, maybe it was a client actually, she was telling me how she got arrested for stealing a car. I can't remember the story, whether she stole it or her boyfriend stole it. And they found drugs in the car, and her father had to come bail her out of jail. And she wasn't a person particularly, she was a teenager, you know, I think she was 16. And she wasn't someone who, like, always got in trouble with anything, but, you know, she was a little bit rebellious. And she, of course, was very afraid about, you know, disappointing her father and letting him down. And she said, I think it came up because I asked her what was, you know, her parents like and what did she learn from them. And she said, when I was working with her, she was only 17 or 18. And she said the most amazing thing. She said, you know, the time I got arrested, and my father, who actually happened to be a policeman, I believe, he came and bailed me out of jail. And all he asked me was, what did I think of the criminal lifestyle? He never said anything else. And that was a memory for her, and she didn't ever have run-ins with the law again, and it really was like a turning point for her. It's interesting, isn't it? Because those things might happen with us, but I could say he was focused on the long term. Right? So, and then the other thing is, you know, so how do you deal with conflict with kids? You know, how do you deal with conflict? That's another one that comes up a lot. My child is having a hard time at school with these certain people, or she's in trouble, or he's in trouble. And then you're a Buddhist. You know, as a Buddhist, what's different? What's different than being a Buddhist than just being a good parent? Is there a difference? Probably not. Except one thing. Motivation. So you're going to stay motivated that you want to use your parenthood as a means for you to become awakened, to develop the awakening mind. Otherwise, there's not as much benefit. And you want your children to get as close to that as possible too. So then you think about effects. This is another thing I want to share with you. Causes are important to look at, but I think first look at effects. So if let's say your child's in, I don't know, having struggles. What are the effects you're looking for? In other words, so, I don't know what example. Anyone want to give an example? I can think of many. But anyone want to give me an example? Yeah.
Like, for instance, if your child is not polite to you or really
right.
Teenage years,
right.
Really, like, they don't want to talk to you,
right.
They don't want to be on their cell phone.
Perfect.
And so then, you know, you don't want to nag them all the time, but it's like they're you know, in those years, 16, they're like, leave me alone.
Right.
And it's hard.
Yeah. I think grab their cell phone out of their hand and flush it down the toilet. So perfect example.
They have to have.
Yeah, I know they have to. So perfect example. Perfect example. So now I can ask you. So what's the effect you're looking for? So that event is happening. What is it? What effect do you want to have? What result would you be happy with? What result are you focusing on?
The effect is that I would like them. I would like her to be respectful of us and everybody, and I would like not to be on the cell phone doing Snapchat, be more involved in studies and getting more involved in life, not silly little things.
Okay.
Which I think is silly.
You think silly. There's so much we can talk about. So first thing I'd say is, you know, we need, as a parent, as just human beings, need to separate our issue from their issue, number one. Okay? So it might be my issue that I want them to respect me, for example. I mean, no one likes rude talk. I know what you mean. I had teenagers like that. Comes with a territory. But now, what effect does it have to say things like, I don't want you to speak rudely to me, and I don't want you to have your... You know, what? Every kid's different, too, so we can't... You know, there's no blanket answer. You have four. So there's no
one. This is just one.
And they're all different, right?
Yeah, completely.
So one of the things is you think about the effect. I don't want her to speak rudely to me. You know, no one likes that. How do you exact that effect? This is a question you should always be asking. So the point is, before, as I say, one more thing. It's all about inquiry. Don't come in with sets of rules. Don't come in with sets of prescriptions. Okay? Be a learner. So as a parent, it's about being a learner. Okay, so if you, I'm not, just to pick on you because you asked the question. So let's just say, so the first thing I say to you is, I would really encourage you to be a learner. So you need to drop your conceptions of what's going on, right? We don't know what's going on, really. Maybe she's being teased at school, and she's got to assert herself. You've got all kinds of theories, assumptions we could go with. We don't know, right?
Exactly.
So why not become curious about her situation?
She won't talk. She doesn't want to talk to us about it.
Right.
I'd say we're very curious about it.
Just say to her, let us know when you're ready to talk. I'm around.
Mm-hmm.
If you force her to talk, does it work?
Not for long.
No. And what kind of person do you maybe, not definitely, maybe need to be for her to talk to? She probably won't, but if she were, what kind of person would you need to be? You don't have to answer that right now. Those are the kinds of questions you're asking, okay? I always tell parents, and that's when I say, number one, your job, our job. Number one, if I said, and it sounds, I don't mean to sound trite, but your number one job is to love her. Okay. So, and then you want her to know that. And so if you want her to know, as best you can go into her head, how would you show up so that she's convinced that, because there'll be a time later on she'll start talking again. If she knows you love her. Now, if the parent, in this case, starts developing this narrative, she won't talk to me, she won't talk to me. Why are you so distant? Why are you so distant? Why are you so rude? Why are you so rude? That narrative becomes reality, right? And it's just a narrative. So have a different narrative. And think long term. See, the rudeness is really right now. I can't stand when they do, oh my God. I don't know who was worse. My daughter at a teenager, the sons were worse. I mean, in terms of that thing, that rudeness. My daughter could throw a few good ones too. You know? And what happens? So your son says that, daughter? This is why it's so amazing. Because they say, and your ego gets hurt, doesn't it? That's why it's our practice first. Okay? First we have to go there. Think about, why am I? Oh, because I'm her father. What does that mean? Why should be in control? She should listen to me. All those assumptions. That's almost like you run out, it's almost like you don't have time to say anything to her because you got a lot of work to kind of, it's all comes back to reflective, not reflective listening, reflective listening to yourself. Right? And, you know, if she knows that you love her and you really respect her and you care for her and you just say, hey, when you're ready, you know, I understand, and just actually, if you do that, you probably will understand why she doesn't talk to you. Most teenagers don't want to talk to their parents. And a lot of it's the narrative of teenagers in their school, you know, like that. I mean, sometimes it happens that teenage kids do speak to their parents. My kids were pretty good, but there were times when they definitely didn't want me, you know, talking to them about much stuff except for, you know, giving them a ride to the boardwalk or something. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I want to get back. The point is, reflect on what's going on for you. Mm-hmm. Reflect on what effect do you want. What do you want her to become? And what she's experienced now is just it's a blip in time. Unless you exaggerate it. Why are you so rude? Why are you so rude? And then the narrative starts. And if you're a rude teenager, what do you do? Do you change? Oh, sorry, Dad. I'm going to be really nice to you now. No. Gets more irritated, more distance from Dad. Dad sees he's rude. I'm not rude. I'm just don't want to talk to him, you know. My friend at school, they're all doing this weird thing. And why doesn't Dad just leave me alone? But it's narrative. Rude. You see what I'm saying?
Cell phone, too. The fear that cell phone is, it just makes kids... can withdraw. Not just kids, a lot of people.
Yes,
they just like spend all their time.
I know.
And it's like, you know, you got to get out there and...
So I think that it can work, one of those prescriptions. Again, as a compassionate father, a father who's trying to develop compassion, you can, and this is just comes from normal parenting advice, you can share with her what it's like for you. But you have to be clear on your motivation. Not, you know, you can't do it in a manipulative way to get her to stop. You have to do it just, you know, I just want you, what's her name? First name?
Yeah.
Anna. So you just say, you know, Anna, I just want you to know, it's really hard for me when you're texting at the table. There's something we can do about that. That's all. Not to give all the power to her, but, you know, if you're going to have a power struggle with the kid, you're going to lose. Anybody won one? I'm just curious. It's difficult, isn't it?
I agree. Yeah.
You did. And what was the result?
I love stories from moms who've like been there.
So I love stories from like people who have been there and had a great success story. And this is one from my friend Mary. And Mary's success story was that she planned a car trip for.
Say it again.
She planned a road trip.
Mm-hmm.
So she and her a 13-year-old, like the malcontent at the moment. She planned a car trip, and I guess they were going to Nashville was the destination, so a place that was ages and ages away. And she made it, so her rules for the trip were that the cell phone had to go in the trunk, that no other entertainment was going to be offered, and that she was not going to start a conversation until they got there. That was her rule, because she hadn't had a conversation with this kid for like ages and ages.
Right.
And so she was like, I have to put something in this kid's path where the best opportunity for them, or the best option for them, is to communicate.
Right.
So this is like, I'm totally playing this with my four kids, but she said that it took until like almost Asheville.
Oh, yeah.
And finally the kids were like, da, 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 da.
Isn't that interesting?
But that was the only option the kid had for entertainment. There was no music. There
but
was
she
no.
was willing to go.
She Nashville. Was willing
okay,
to go.
That's,
and she was
that's
like,
good. I like that.
Well,
it's negotiation, right?
Yeah, I guess there was something in Asheville that was like a desirable thing. I don't know. But that was, so, and she's also said that there would be no judgment for anything else that happened.
Right.
Like anything that happened at home. She was willing to let that go. She was like, if we get home from this trip and it's, you know, closed clam for like 6 more months, I have to be okay with that.
So you reminded me of something. So go back to Anna for a second. Did I cut you off?
Yeah.
You did. And you reminded me and I forgot. Hate that when it happens. Well, one thing is what you reminded me of was that there is collaboration. In other words, you could say there's a problem, and you can own it as your problem, right? But the thing that changes it is getting into some kind of dialogue. And also, we're in your case, you know, they can be part of the solution. Okay, so you come in without preconception that the solution has to be such as a... I wonder how your friend thought of that, though. Because kids do want to connect with people. There's no doubt. They do want to connect. Like I said, there's a lot of this narrative around their friends about parents and all that sort of thing. And also maybe we begin to bug them because we so much want to connect with them, and it's painful losing that connection as they get older. You know, it changes to a different kind of connection. By the way, don't worry, they come back. Okay, they can't afford to live on their own. At least we live where I am. They have, you know. But so what you're really thinking about is you're thinking about the future. You're thinking about you don't want to ruin your relationship with them. It's harder, the cell phones, the computer, all that sort of thing. What I would do is that's one approach. I think it'd be very creative. I think that's what the thing that your friend did is you sort of throw out the preconceptions and start thinking creatively. Also, you know, there is something, so even though I said, if you get into a power trip with a kid, you'll lose, and you told your story, it doesn't mean that you give them the power either. That's not the idea here, and that's the other extreme that happens these days, is that parents are very unwilling or feel very insecure about being assertive. You know, probably to think to love your child means to make okay. This is a good one. Because I was asking, the other question was, how do you want to be with your child? You know, what kind of parent do you want to be? What do you be proud of? You know, I think about for myself, well, my children at some point will trust me. It's like the thing around drinking, you know, if you have teenagers or something or getting high, and you could say, you know, you can't drink till you're 21, you can't get high, you know, you can't do it, do anything like that. And then, how realistic is, I mean, is that helpful? Maybe you have to say that. Maybe better to say, well, I hope you don't. But you see, you really want them to call you when they're 17 and drunk and stuck at a party. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things you do. You look at what the effects you want. You look at what relationship you want. And we don't like them to get drunk at a party, you know. But that's not the point, really, at this point. So how do you develop, who do you need to be so they will call you? They have to see you as non-judgmental and understanding. It doesn't mean you don't have judgment. It means you love them first. That you want the best for them. They know that, and you're not going to, you're looking for the effect. So the effect is I don't like my child to drink, or is the effect that you want your child to call you if they're in trouble? To think about these things. To be realistic. Okay? I just want them to drink, but I don't know if we can stop that. I don't know the method, personally. I think even in the monasteries they might have that problem. Who knows?
I think you want to develop a good relationship so that whatever happens, you have an open communication and you're not...
The main thing is relationship. And it's impermanent. You see, so we bring our own practice. This always comes down to practice into it. We remember impermanence. We remember the preciousness of this life. We remember karmic imprints, all that stuff. You know, and how much control do we... So your child, my child, comes into this world with their karmic imprints. That's scary. So maybe it's not about your parenting sometimes. Maybe you're not doing something wrong. We know a lot of kids like that, right? I mean, there are a lot of families struggle. Yeah, and it seems the parents do everything right. So you just have to make sure you do everything as best you can, what's from your heart and your values, as much as you can. And the main value should be love and acceptance. That's number one. And that they trust. So if it becomes your practice, then, I want to say something about that. Again, I think that we've gotten screwed up, I want you to understand the context, because it can sound weird, but in the monasteries back when I was there, they're very strict, you know, they're very strict in the monasteries, and they used to use corporal punishment. I don't think they do anymore, by the way. You know, because they seem outdated. But when I was there, I was sort of required and commanded to, you know, if I had to use corporal punishment. I mean, it's kind of hard to say that in this group, you know, these days I'm a therapist and all these sort of things, you know. But I understand that, you know, so I don't want you, I hope I'm not saying this in a way that makes some misunderstanding. But it was context, it was cultural. I'm not talking about beating, you know, I'm nothing about, you know, I'm not talking about. And of course it's outdated now, but one day I was walking home to Kopan, and I was with Lama Zopa Rinpoche. And Lama Yeshe used to tell me, you know, you need to take a big stick or you need to take your mala. You know, kind of like being intimidating. And, you know, I'm a California guy, so, you know. But he kept telling me, and I understand now why he told me. These kids were very tough. You know, they're very, very, very tough lifestyles. They came from the Himalayas, they often have shoes, you know, they walk through the snow barefoot, and they, you know, eat, yeah, you know what I mean. We're talking a rough lifetime. It's strong. They're strong. And they see a weakness in you, and forget it. I had one teacher, so I have volunteer teachers, this is very common. We use volunteer teachers. And this one teacher who had been, had volunteered, you know, not, I mean, obviously she was, you know, well experienced. And can you believe it? This is just, I said, Lama used to set me up. So he came up, he sidled up to me and he said, "That's your new teacher?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Tell her she needs to take a big stick to class." I said, Lama, I can't tell her that. You tell her. You know, so part of our practice as Buddhists, you know, you can question your guru once, but if he says it again, you know, come what may, you got to do it. You know, so I go, oh God, you know, I got to tell this lady. And I went up to her, and I knew when I told her, I mean, it wasn't going to go well. So she was about to start her class in an hour. I told her, well, you know, you need to take a big stick to class. Can you believe this? Yeah, I'm telling you, but let alone told her. But I did. I had to. And she just turned on me, and she said, I've been teaching in inner city of Oakland for 8 years. You know, the roughest kids, I've never had a discipline problem. You know, I'm not taking any stick to class. So I don't know what you're talking about. True story. So a couple hours later, I was coming down into the courtyard, and there she was, in the courtyard, with her bags repacked. And she saw me, and she just, you know, she lashed out at me. She had tears coming down her. And really, this is a true story. I don't know where you got these kids. They're the worst kids I've ever had to teach. They don't listen to anybody. I don't know what you're doing here. And she stormed off. She didn't make it through a whole class. They tore her apart. You know? That's all. Beautiful kids, by the way. Not like criminals or anything. They're just Himalayan kids. You know, they're just different. A different culture. So, Rinpoche, Lama Zom Rinpoche, you know, he knew about my troubles because I didn't like, you know, having to be a disciplinarian, you know, looking tough and all those kinds of things. And I was sort of the headmaster for the Western education for the boys. And so one day I was walking by Lama Zopa Rinpoche, and people know Lama Zopa here. Very gentle, right? Yeah. Lama Yeshe was, you know, when Lama Yeshe used to come down the steps from the top of the mountain, people, all the monks would scatter. And they'd be sitting there going, what just happened? They'd be so, you know, because he was intimidating. And he's not the only, you know, they're gone, you know. But they also knew him as their mother, he was also their mother. I mean, it wasn't that they disliked him. His power was just, you know, that was his role. You know, he's the father. He's gonna, those kids didn't have a father. So he played that role. But they knew his love was, unfathomable for them, but they were intimidated, like me. So, I was walking home with Rinpoche when I'm back to Kopan, and he turned to me and said, "So Lama tells you to you need to be strict with the kids, and you know maybe need to they say beat they don't mean beat you know but you know like spank or whatever you had to do." And I said, "Yeah, Rinpoche, that's like that." And he said, you know, there's some kids that you might discipline and they get better. And there's some kids you discipline and they might get worse. There's no prescriptions. That's why we need inquiry. We need open mind, open heart. Really be curious about our kids. Curiosity. Be a learner. Don't think you know how to parent. I have ideas. We should educate ourselves, 100%. You know, educate on, but be clear on the values that you want to share. Be clear on your values. That's one thing to learn. You know, not wishy-washy. I mean, so that thing about some kids get better and some kids get worse. So you have to learn that. You know, just be nice to our kids is not necessarily what's best for them. And we see a lot today, don't we, about this indulgence. It's pretty scary. Yeah, so I wanted my kids, you know, just like those kids in Kopan, I want them to be tough, actually. Life is tough. The world is tough. And I'm not sure a lot of these kids, the philosophy on training them is training them to be tough. Sure, warm and compassionate we want, but I wrote down here something from my wife that I got because she works with training teachers and kids and all that sort of, you know, trained parents. And her program, the three key words are knowledge, strength, and compassion. Somehow knowledge and strength is, particularly strength, is being lost. It seems, doesn't it? Is this me? You think better? Yeah. So strength. So getting clear on what it means to raise strong children Okay, and if we're going to raise strong children, guess what makes somebody strong? Knowledge. What else?
Adversity.
Yeah. Tough. To be strong means learning is having problems. So when your daughter comes home, like mine did from middle school, and the girls are being mean, okay, well, my method was I was going to go beat the crap out of those girls. But fortunately, my wife was there. So, you know, she taught me, no, you don't do that. That's a natural reaction, right? I don't know for you, but anyways, I think it's natural reaction for some people. Boy, I hope I don't get sued for this. I'm just joking. But then you do feel that, right? You do feel like you want to protect your child, so you're going to do anything, and you're going to maybe go talk to the parents. But my wife's very skillful, and so she you problem solve with your child, and then the child goes back and has to deal with it. It's painful, right? You might just do. But by her going back, I mean, I think that experience for my daughter, I believe that she really developed certain qualities that she carries today. You know, a sort of a resilience, an understanding, an empathy too. Because that's not, you know, mean girls, you know, it's not, that dilemma is not going to go away. There's a lot of mean people you're going to face in the world. Okay? So that's what the long-term view. So what do you need to do now when your daughter comes to you and says that? You need to think, right? So it's not being hung up on the moment. That's what gets us to be bad parents, is we get caught in the moment. You're not going to talk to me that way. You're going to put your phone away. That's all in the moment. I'm not saying we like it. My kids still text at the table. You know. I don't know if that's helpful or not. I don't know. Just some ideas.
Yeah.
There's 100,000 the problems, right, as a parent. So the main thing that answers all the problems is be really clear in your own balance, okay? Deal with one other thing that might be helpful. Lama Lindrup was the headmaster at Kopan. He's worked under Lama Yeshe, and we worked together for all those years. Great Lama. I mean, really, really fantastic Lama. He died a few years ago. His incarnation was recognized a few months ago. And he was very gentle. You know, he never did anything, you know, was not... We had lamas there that were just, that were pretty, you know, rough. You know, had lamas. But Lama Lindrup wasn't one of them. And Lama Zopa wasn't one of them. And Lama Yeshe was one of them. But Lama Lindrup, I remember talking to him about it, and he said, because, you know, it troubled me. And he told me two different things, two different times. But one thing he told me, he says, Lama Yeshe has told you to do that, but you can never do it when you're angry. You can never discipline them or, you know, whatever, when you're angry. And that meant so much to me, I'm telling you today, because one boy, I did smack him on the back of the head. I was angry at him. You know, I did other times when I wasn't angry. Not a lot, just, you know, 3 or 4 times. That one. And we were close, that boy and I. I mean, as close as most, but he was, and when I did that, he didn't talk to me for years. And I attributed it to the fact I was angry. Motivation. It's not so much the action, it's the motivation. I mean, of course, we're not talking about violence, you know, but I'm just saying, be focused on your motivation. If you're angry and irritated with your daughter, just because we're talking, if you're angry and irritated with your daughter on the cell phone, don't do anything. I mean, sometimes we can't. We have to do something, you know, if it's a dangerous situation. But generally, I'd say it's not going to have a good effect. Same thing if you're fearful. You know, like for my daughter, let's say I was fearful for, you know, how these kids were treating her. Not good. She's going to pick up on that. It's very self-centered, right? The advice I give her is for me. It seems like for her, But I haven't listened to her. I'm not in her world. So as Buddhists, you know, in developing compassion, number one, is our number one goal, compassionate mind. Well, develop compassion means getting into their world, getting into their experience. Get into her experience. And you might not be able to do it in 1 hour. It might take months. Then when you say something, you go, oh, that, I know that's exactly the right thing. So we have to have empathy and get into our child's experience, no matter how old they are. And that's really compassion. Then you're able to do it with their friends and the other young people and people, and it starts expanding. That's pretty awesome. You know, you'll be able to do the guy at work that you can't stand. He keeps leaving his door open and plays that terrible music. Right? So your kids are your guru. You don't need to see Lama Zopa, Geshe La, Swami, whatever, whoever your guru is. You don't need to see them every day. If we open our minds, our kids are our guru. I mean, the whole world becomes our guru. We talked last night a little bit. I didn't get to that one last night. Thought transformation. Okay? In thought transformation, one of the main practices you do is everything and everyone is your guru. Your guru is manifesting to everybody. You know, when we talked last night, I think you asked a question. One thing I left out was about motivation. Because when we don't talk about motivation, then, a perfect example, let's talk about kids, not just how much you extrapolate, meditation. Is meditation Buddhist or not Buddhist? How many say meditation is Buddhist? How about a Buddhist meditation like meditating on the perfect human rebirth? Is that Buddhist? No. Sorry. It's my tricky thing. Why isn't it Buddhist? Depends on the motivation. I mean, mindfulness is being taught everywhere now. In everything. Is it Buddhist? Is it Hindu? Is it, what is it? Okay? What makes something Buddhist or not Buddhist is different. It has a lot to do with it's the mindset. Okay, it's the motivation. You know, perfect human rebirth, you know, as soon as people are meditating on the perfect human rebirth at Google, are they doing Buddhist meditation? No, probably not. It's good. I'm not saying positive. I didn't say positive, negative, by the way. It's probably positive. We're a Buddhist here, so we're talking about Buddhist. So Buddhist motivation is with compassion, particularly with the awakening mind. Okay, so you sit with your daughter. So this is very important. So you're faced with a problem with your children, something, a dilemma. And if you go first to, normally where we go is the self-grasping mind, right? Everyone knows about the self-grasping mind. Nothing new. You know, self-grasping mind means seeing ourselves as truly existent, solid, truly existent. Okay? And so when she, this is a great example, when she has her cell phone out, or my kid, you know, when she has her cell phone, okay, so who's showing up? So probably the self-grasping, self-cherishing mind. I don't like she's doing this. What should I do? I can't stand she, but Karuna said don't do this. Now maybe I should do that. What do I do? To change it is to first focus on who's upset. And you'll get where you should be able to do that in just, 10, 20 seconds. So you're lying in bed with your child and he says, Mommy, does everyone die? And you're like, oh, shit. You know, that's scary when kids are thinking about that. Because you know what the next question is? Are you going to die? Usually it's mommy. Are you going to die, mommy? Right. So that's a perfect example. What happens when they ask that? And you get that, oh, no. So your meditation is on that mind. Who's reacting? Self-grasping, self-cherishing mind. Okay? So now your daughter, your son is giving you the opportunity to awaken a little bit. Because rather than answering right away, you've checked in and go, wow. Really, it really affected me. It really brought up my concrete sense of self. And when we practice more and more, we know that concrete sense of self doesn't exist at all. Like that. So you're not even answering. Meanwhile, you've gone into samadhi and you're just lying there. Anyway, so you reflect on that really quick. And so now it becomes how you answer the question has really is really affected by, you know, your own busyness in there. It's about you. And that part, if that person softens and you really see that, then you respond. You'll know better how to respond. And by the way, the answer to that question, do you respond or not, depends, right? Depends how old the child is. It depends on the context. It does. But what we're talking about in terms of parenting is, first and foremost, what's happening to you? Then when you dissolve, you know, if you can loosen up that self-grasping, then you can speak compassionately. You can act compassionately. You can't act compassionately when you're in the way. I mean, you can, but not to a very high level. So what do you think, actually, in that question? How have people handled that question? Just, I'm curious now.
Well,
yeah, if your child asked you.
I don't, I mean, obviously it's different for everybody, but that's death is not anything that we've skirted around with at all. And after talking to other people, I realized that, you know, even some adults have grown up in a life that was, for whatever reason, navigated around death. Like, they just weren't exposed to it, and they built their own feelings around it, and it affects how they answer that question also. We had plenty of family members die growing up. It was a very constant and pervasive thing in my life. And so it's that particular question we tend to answer very straightforward.
Yeah, I don't think that question comes up for a lot of traditional cultures because of just what you're saying. The children see death. They see the grandparents die, whatever, around them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It has honestly been a question that has gotten easier to process through, though.
Mm-hmm.
I heard you asking about other religions earlier, but in the Christian faith, I was born and raised very Southern Baptist, and I felt like a lot of people had more trepidation around that question, even if they weren't imminently afraid of death itself, but more the concept that it was a once and done, like you had to get it done.
Mm.
And so the imminence of it was that you haven't gotten things right yet.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't like that was the closure for something. And,
right.
And so the conversation now of like, it's a continuum.
Right.
Like, yeah, it's going to happen. Like the trees fall off the leaves. It's a thing that happens. The conversation is a lot more fluid and possible.
Right.
But it's not just like a once and done, like you haven't gotten things right yet.
Yeah, yeah.
And so in some ways that conversation's gotten even easier now.
How old are your kids?
5, 10, and 11.
Mm-hmm.
And it manifests in different ways also. I mean, dogs dying and chickens dying and
I agree with you.
Like that.
Yeah.
But still it's a I feel like an easier conversation, but
do you think would you have the conversation differently with your children based on their age?
Yeah, because I feel like we tried to handle it different ways. But regardless, the 5-year-old was, you know, like this past February, we had a 12-year-old, like, family dog die.
Mm-hmm.
So, especially for the 5-year-old, like, very well-established family member by the time that he came into the world.
Right.
And that the death of that dog was, like, at least a 4 to 6 month conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah,
part of it is a cultural problem because, like I said, in some cultures, I mean, death's just so it is natural anyway. Just for some reason, this culture, it's not handled. I mean, it's seen as an aberration almost, right?
Right.
So I think the natural part of it makes it almost a non-conversation, or, you know, makes the conversation much easier. So that comes back to your family values, right?
Mm-hmm.
How we can be really clear on our family values with your partner, if, you know, is what are our family values? You need to have that conversation more than once. Rather than assuming you have the same values, really talk about them. And then figure it out. I mean, there's, like I said, there's no prescriptions. Because once you have your values, you go, okay, well, we're committed to being open about death. I'm not sure how to do it, but that's the discussion. You know, well, should we do it today or tomorrow? Should we tell all of it, part of it? That's just something creative, and there's no prescription. But the values part is very important. Yeah.
So, a question about
that. Uh-oh. When she says that, it makes me think, did I say something wrong?
No, not at all. But I'm stumbling through this a little bit. So when you say you have to have your family values in place, that sounds awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I am very, very new to the Buddhist party.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like there's so many concepts that are new to me as a human being. Like, I didn't grow up in a family of any organized faith.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are a lot of things that I'm encountering for the first time. So
so
this might be familiar to you, but you're probably a good person to ask.
Yeah.
I feel like we have definitely some values in place, but we don't necessarily have a value that correlates to every such situation that comes up.
Right.
And there are some things that I feel like, just as the kids are stumbling through it for the first time, we're stumbling through it for the first time. Or when I say we, I mean me. And I don't necessarily know how to handle it, and I feel myself being prone to more knee-jerk reactions because I am so insecure. And even on a values level where I feel like I should be more certain, I feel like I should totally have this together, like I'm 39.
Really?
And I don't.
I don't either. You know, we're having, like, even I'm talking.
Even a core value, not even an application of it, just the value itself. Like, what the expletive do I think about this is a question I ask myself more than daily.
That's okay. I understand. Yeah, I think the only difference, my only disagreement is I don't feel as insecure about you as you feel about yourself. I think it's okay. I don't think any of us, can I generalize? I don't think any of us are at the end of our understanding of our values. For example, compassion, compassion is one of my values, probably yours too. But in my personal development of compassion, have I done it? No, I don't think I'll ever finish. Right? So as I progress in my development of compassion, then my understanding of compassion will deepen, won't it? So my understanding of compassion, so what I'm trying to say is, if I, whatever problem my son or daughter brought to me 16, 20 years ago, whatever it was, I responded from my value of compassion, but it probably may have been quite different how I am today, because my understanding of compassion has deepened. Okay? So I wouldn't worry about when you get to the point that you know your values, understand your values. I understand you're in an exploratory period right now. I get that. But you have plenty of values that are dear to you, and they'll never stop being developed. So what you tell your children today from your values might be different in 10 years from now. It's true. But the point, again, motivation, remember? So you're motivated to do the right thing. You're motivated to do the right thing for your children. And if you can just, because you want to create a better world, have a positive impact, just hang on to that, and that's good enough. Okay? Don't have to get so philosophical. Slowly, later on. I mean, slowly, can't stop you. Right? You're already curious.
That's true, but the visual metaphor I've always had in my mind, like the running metaphor that I keep coming back to, is this house.
House.
And there's certain, like, every house looks different, and it's built in a different way for different needs and a different family and different styles.
Mm-hmm.
But there have to be certain elements in a certain order for it to be a functional standing,
You need structure. A foundation. You need a good foundation.
And that's the part I feel like I'm struggling with. And you already spoke to a lot of it, and I'll pick up the rest, as I live. But that's the part where I feel like that foundation is so eroding all the time. Like, it's so unstable, bless you. And it's That's the part I struggle with. That's the part, like, visually in my head, I feel like that foundation is just being washed away. Like, it's like the screen door. It's more of a screen door. It's like always getting slammed if something gets through.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
No, I understand. I think I understand. Just last comment on that is, I'm sure everyone here probably maybe had the same feeling. You know, houses get old, and sometimes you tear out the foundation. And that sounds like maybe that's just what's happening. You know, some of your foundation really was not, so maybe it was before a 10-year-old house, not a 100-year-old house, so now you're placing for more 100-year. And that's, you know, we do feel insecure when that's happening. We do feel nervous, not scared. But that's okay. It comes with kind of the learning territory. It comes with the territory. That's not unusual. Just keep at it. Okay? Nothing's going to collapse. I don't think. Okay? Yes.
I had a question.
Yeah.
I had a comment and then a question. And the comment was that when you were talking about the introspection, and I very different from Anna, we have a 2-year-old, so the other end of the spectrum. But your point about introspection is something that kind of hit home, because one of the things I realize already in some of the challenges, we have a very spirited child, and so, you know, start reading books about a spirited child.
Yeah,
and then
I have the
realization that, wait, this book's talking about me and not my son.
Right.
Because I'm totally that. I could spend 3 hours thinking about the perfect way to put the carpet down, and the carpet's a little as cute, and it's, you know, all hell breaks loose.
Right.
And so in that sense, you know, what you were talking about, Lama Yeshe telling you that, you know, kind of guiding you towards parenting is really your spiritual
path.
And I sort of see that for myself.
Yeah.
But I guess my question was, you talked about the two elements, the element of how do I raise my children to be Buddhist, but then also how do I pursue, and this is kind of where we struggle a little bit, is how do we pursue the spiritual path when suddenly life seems so overwhelming in terms of, like, staying on schedule and the million things to do. And
yeah. Well, can I answer that? I think it's really helpful to remember that your question is not any different than all of our questions. So here I am, I've raised my children, so I don't have that kind of overwhelm. And I don't have the kind of overwhelm around work, because I'm kind of slowing down and those kinds of things. I'm less ambitious, you know, not creating those kinds of new projects, maybe other kinds of projects. But it's not really any different if, for me and you, even though it might look different, and it is, there is some difference in terms of quality. You guys are, I know that era of young kids, and, you know, it's crazy. But nevertheless, you have to, the givens are no different. And the given is you have to develop your spiritual practice no matter what. And what does that mean? So, to develop your spiritual practice, my understanding when I was younger was about my sitting practice, my formal practice. It's still, you know, don't get me wrong, but I had to be really, I had to eventually let go. You just can't do it that way. I mean, when I was living in Nepal before I had kids, you know, you're doing your couple hour sessions every morning and evening, you're going to pujas, you're going to teaching, whatever. You know, so one way I had a harder time than you, because I probably had a lot of attachment. I knew how it could be. I came back, and now I was, my first child was born, I was about 30, you know. So I had a lot of years. I had 12 years, 13 years. Well, no, he was in Nepal with me a few years. But whatever. You know, 8, 9, 10 years in Nepal, you know, in my rhythm. So one way I had it worse than you, because I had all this attachment, you know, all this lifestyle that I had to throw out. And so it's harder in one way, I could say. And we do need formal practice. We do need sitting practice. And we do need to study. And we do need to read, because we need the ideas, you know, to apply. You know, which ideas are we applying? You can't just, it's not like anything goes, you know. You know, this is some really serious ideas. But what you do is you have to, I would say, to be a little strict, you have to have a few minutes a day of focused meditation or analytical meditation. In other words, you need a few minutes of formal session. As parents, when they're young, it's going to be harder than when they get to going to school or going to even preschool. I will say that. So you got to hang in there and do your best. After that, you can probably fit in. All you need is 20 minutes. If you can do more, great. 20 minutes, and then continue reading or studying or going to a class once a week. And then you help each other, you know, 1 week you go, 1 week you go, like that. Until later, then you can do. You need a little bit, but don't stress about it. You can't do very much when your children are really little. You know, now it's, you know, in that case, now you can do more than when I was, because, you know, you have podcasts and you have things on, you can put on in your car when you're driving them back, when you're driving home from dropping them off and that sort of thing. And then they take a nap and you can put on a podcast or something like that. You have to be sort of creative. My one thing I would say is to really try to do is just, if you can help each other, is 10 minutes in the morning and maybe 10 minutes at night. Best you can. Not so much you can't. You're too tired at night. Just 10 minutes and 10 minutes. 10 minutes and 10 minutes. Okay? And then slowly you'll get more. Unless you keep having children. I guess eventually that stuff. Well, you might adopt them. I don't know. So yeah, it is hard. Let's make it clear. It is a hard, hard practice. But every day, motivate that this is your spiritual practice. Okay, then you don't develop resentment, for one thing, and then it is your spiritual practice. I don't know where we got these ideas, spiritual practices about meditation cushion. You know, that's not right. The meditation cushion, you need that 10 minutes so that the rest of your day will be spiritual practice. You know, we do need that. It's rehearsal. So yeah, I get it. In myself, if I don't do the rehearsal, I don't do very good through the day. So you need some rehearsal. But at this early, you know, certain stage, you've got to be realistic. How much rehearsal can I do? Well, I only got 10 minutes. But do that 10 minutes then. Don't miss on something. Maybe it has to be in the car. I don't know. But when I talk about rehearsal, that means not studying, but reflecting. Okay? Reflecting, contemplating, and then if you can, even do a little focus meditation. 7 minutes of focus meditation, 3 minutes of analytical meditation. Best you can do. You know, instead of, I mean, you know, we think because, I mean, this Tibetan Buddhist approach is so attractive. We get all these pujas to do and all these practices to do. And, you know, when I had my first child, I already had like an hour and a half or 2 hours a day of commitments. So I'd taken all these commitments. Now what am I going to do? I kept them, but yeah, it's hard. I kept them because I have an unbelievable wife that covered for me. It wasn't very fair to her, but that's what happened.
That's right.
Goodbye. So let's just, is there anything else? Because I think people need, I mean, it's 8:37. Good enough? Okay. So, I don't know. This is a big subject. Thank you for letting me blah, blah, blah. And thank you for sharing. Really, it's so helpful for me when people speak up and share. So I appreciate that. I have so much to learn, so I appreciate it. Hopefully it's helpful for others. So let's just think for a moment. The energy, we generated quite a bit of energy last hour and a half. Within our minds, within our potential, our beings, is something that's very different than what's our ordinary way of being. That's why we study, that's why we do these practices, because we have the potential to have a fully clear mind, fully clear, free of the fog, the ignorance and misunderstanding, lack of knowledge. All these things are obscuring our clear, wise, blissful mind. Each of us have it. Each of us will develop it. Each of us will attain that. It's who we really are. And that awakening mind is of the greatest benefit to ourselves and all other living beings. When that awakening mind fully or as it begins to develop more and more and more, we actually have the true means to help others. That's when you relate to your children from that awakening mind, you can't do anything wrong. Doesn't mean they'll change the way you want them to because they have their karmic imprints, but it does mean that you've done the best that can be done. So dedicate any energy that we generate here to the attainment of that awakening mind. And that awakening mind is balanced with the understanding that it doesn't exist truly but from its own side. It's completely dependent on other sentient beings. And all this energy, last but not least, generated to the long life of His Holiness Dalai Lama, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, and Geshe Gelug, and any other teachers that are teaching true paths. Okay, thank you.
Thank you
very much. Sorry to go on, blah, blah. Anything else to announce or anything? Good.